Welcome back to the fourth and final segment of our Beef Roundtable discussion on how the change in Washington leadership might impact agriculture and the beef industry in particular. In the third segment, we focused our discussion on the 2018 Farm Bill. In this segment, our guests Steve Dittmer and Jay Truitt will focus on immigration reform and how that might affect animal agriculture. I'm Dr. Ron Lemonager, Beef Extension Specialist at Purdue University.
And I'm Bert Rutherford, Senior Editor of Beef Magazine. I'm based in Denver, Colorado. Immigration was really one of Donald Trump's rallying cries that helped elevate him to the highest office in the land and perhaps the most powerful position in the world. In rural America, as you mentioned, back to Mr. Trump, was 62% of his voting bloc. 71%, however, of our crop workers are foreign-born. Nearly half are not legally authorized to work in the United States. You know, that's statistics coming from USDA. And immigration has, in all of our careers, been really, a constant issue, a constant controversy. What are we looking at now, going forward? How is our new administration going to balance what agriculture needs in terms of labor and with the policies that Mr. Trump espoused while he was on the campaign trail?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take a shot at parts of the conversation. I'm not sure anybody can, we all think what we would like for it to happen, but I will tell you what's not going to happen. And it's the same thing that wasn't going to happen in the last two or three Congresses and the last two or three administrations. And it finally, I think the thing that Trump tapped into was this. We're not going to do any kind of comprehensive immigration package. It's not going to happen. Congress can't deal with all the complexities of the issue at one time. There's too much separation between all the different sides. And I think one of the thing I credit Trump for was figuring out how to segment out the conversation in a way that normal people, everybody in America, tends to kind of think about it. Border security is its own issue, and it stands on its own. Clearly, he's laid down the law on what he's going to do there. I think he has plenty of support on Capitol Hill to get through that. Congress has already approved building a wall a decade ago almost, and so it's not like he needs to ask anymore anybody else to help him in that process. But what that does do is allow that mechanical process to get started. And I think that actually helps us fix what are some real issues, especially from an agricultural perspective, involving immigration. Trying to operate in certain sorts of settings, you know that you're gonna come headlong into potentially hiring somebody that is here inappropriately. And the question is how do you actually hire enough people to run a processing plant or run a large-scale harvesting operation when you know that there's about a dozen things you cannot ask them or make them prove to you about who they really are or really aren't. And yet you're liable for that. And so until we can actually get some of those other conversations out of the way, I don't think you can actually resolve this kind of round two of the conversation until everybody can just focus on it. And honestly, building the wall, or whatever it is, that however you want to refer to that whole project, probably actually helps us get to that next step a lot faster. And it takes some of the onus off of people that are aware. I'm not for sure broadly in the beef industry, it's our number one issue if you look at the number of people involved in the industry. But all of our animals have to go through a processing facility where it's a huge issue for them to try to deal with.
Well, that's not the only place in agriculture, obviously, that needs a labor force. The row crop food rather than feed crops are even more dependent on that. And I'm not sure that, I'm hoping that Purdue will be able to get Trump to understand how important a substantial guest worker program is, because there are not a lot of middle class white kids that are dying to get out there and spend all day in the sun bent over picking strawberries or any number of the things that, heck, I dreaded to do in our little garden. It wasn't very big, but I wasn't anxious to get out there in the sun first thing in the morning and pick beans. But if we wanted to eat, that's what we did. But to do that for, and I don't mean for a certain pay. Even when I lived in Panhandle, Nebraska, there were immigrant workers working out in the bean fields, roguing beans. You couldn't pay me to do that. They got a fairly decent wage. I don't remember how much it was for 2.5 acres a day, but it was good money. But it didn't make any difference how much it was going to be. There wouldn't be a large number of people who wanted to do that. There is one thing that I still, and Jay, you can tell me if you think there are enough people in Washington that understand this. The serious problem we've got with employers being able to verify the status of a worker is built into the Social Security Act. There is a sentence in there that says Social Security Administration can verify that a particular number is valid, but it is not allowed to tell an employer. And I've only found one Kansas professor who was aware of this in the last 15 years. They are not allowed to say the 12 or 15 or 20 other people are using that number. And, of course, Jay and I remember the SWIFT raids. In Greeley, a number of years ago, it was not that kind of enforcement raid at all, but it was based on people getting multiple letters from the IRS saying, we appreciate the taxes you paid on your job in Cincinnati, but these three jobs that you've had in Greeley, you didn't pay any tax on.
Right.
That's what put people on buses outside of Greeley from the SWIFT plan, not the fact that they were all using a cousin's Social Security number. And that is something that needs to be fixed if we're ever going to have a verification program that works. And I never hear anybody in Washington talking about it. You know where that status stands, Jay?
No. Well, so you've got, there's two or three champions on the Senate side, especially. You hear maybe fewer people talk about it in the House side, but there have been a number of companies that have proposed technology solutions to that exact problem. You hear a lot of talk about it, but I'll be honest with you, other than sitting through some hearings where it was a topic of conversation for a half a day, and then they moved on to the next item in the agenda, it seems to be, and that discussion is part of the reason why I say, I don't believe it's possible to do comprehensive immigration reform. You have to break this down into components, and that's painful. I mean, nothing in Washington, D.C. is despised more than somebody who thinks that their one little issue is worthy of a floor vote. They always want to be part of a bigger package. That gets a lot easier to manage and to handle. But I think, again, this is one of those areas where I couldn't agree with you more. I think you're exactly spot on the problem and the solution component. I'm convinced if we can fly a drone over Bahrain from here and check street signs and know what color the lights are at an intersection, we can surely figure out how to actually identify people accurately. For employment and help both sides of the equation. To your point, back to your, but I think you have to pressure that to happen. I wanted to go back though a little bit to Steve and your comments about guest worker. I couldn't agree more. My family originated out of West Texas and had those contracts in cotton. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about how those guest worker programs work, prevailing wage requirements that get, you know, installed in them. I do think that that Mr. Purdue and actually some other folks on the Trump internal team at the White House can make that happen. I think that's one of those things where it's going to take some real White House leadership to explain exactly why those people are important. And frankly, I think it becomes one of those things that helps him put off some of the criticism that he's getting in regards to just trying to block a border. He can say, hey, no, this is exactly where we want you to come. These are exactly the vehicles that we want you to use. And this is how you can stay here, work here, live here, be here for as long as there's good employment for you. And hopefully we can bring you back repeatedly over and over and over again. From a PR standpoint, I have urged them to figure out how they actually do exactly that. I don't know whether they are listening to me yet, but I couldn't agree with you more that it's an essential piece of it.
Well, stay with him, Jake. If he got 30% of the Hispanic vote this time around, imagine if we actually had a system where people could come and go legally, have a job, go back home, do what they need to do periodically. I think that would make Hispanics a lot happier, and it would certainly make employers, whether ranchers or farmers or construction people or landscape people, we all need a lot of those labor sources that just doesn't seem to be domestically available, regardless of what some of the people on the other side of the Hudson River think.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, gentlemen, one thing that I think within the cattle industry that perhaps we need to spend a little more time noodling around on, is the packing industry. We can look at our ranches and our farm and ranches combinations, and we just don't hire that many foreign workers. Well, if the packing industry has a supply challenge now, if you want to look at it that way, it's in labor. A couple of years ago, their supply challenge was in cattle. Well, we fixed that problem. Now the challenge is, are those packing plants going to be able to hire enough people to process all the cattle that we're going to send to them? And the ramifications, if they can't, if that really becomes a bottleneck in our business, I think we don't understand the full ramifications of what that might mean to our market.
Well, that's why a guest worker program has to be a lot bigger than it is now or than it has been contemplated in recent years when people look into this. But there's a fallacy I think that people need to understand, too, is you get these criticisms of the packers from people to say, well, they'll just get rid of whatever illegals they've got. They'll hire some more tomorrow. Next week, they'll hire some more. That's not the way it works. It takes a lot of training and a lot of investment by the packers in these people to be able to do the job correctly, to do the kind of trimming, to do the work at the speed that is required and do it safely. And so that takes time and training. And to say, well, you just pick anybody off the street, A, who could do it, or B, who is willing to do it, is a fallacy that I think we need to help them a bit with. And these people have this discussion in Washington. Any employer needs to get back that investment they've made in employees. And what packers are doing, what they have people doing on a regular basis, is not as simple and as easy as people think it is.
Over the decades that I've been involved in lobbying Congress with producers and predominantly beef producers, over the majority of those years, I never remember a producer going in and lobbying their member of Congress and without being prompted or us not really talking about it before, that the H-2A or guest worker program came up, and it's been an issue in this country for 25 or 30 years. So one way or another, we've had issues and concerns. I've also never been in a meeting with a packer that it wasn't the first thing that came up. And so clearly we need to figure out that how we can cooperate as an industry and get that. I think the initial question is one of those that should send cold chills throughout the industry. And it should silence people for a second and let them think, hey, listen, if the plant just closes for the wrong reason, what is the domino impact? And I don't care where the plant is, what's the domino impact throughout the industry, and how long does it take to for us to recover from those each time? Well, you know, when we're selling $2 fats, maybe we think about it a little bit differently. But when you're not, and you're down on the end, you're already losing money, and you're trying to figure out how much are you going to lose in that transaction, certainly it has a different thing. And again, I think producers, I do remember during my tenure at NCBA, we lobbied on H2A all the time. But I can tell you, I was just sitting where when Steve was talking, I was trying to think if I had ever remembered a time period where it came up naturally, that it didn't have to be prompted or it wasn't a part of the conversation. And I just don't remember a time where it was a natural part of the conversation. And it absolutely should be amongst the tens of thousands of producers that could carry that message. It would change the dynamic of the conversation overnight, I think.
Well, and it brings to mind, again, your point that we have to do these things in stages. However, if we're actually going to get a law built and start really restricting things, then a guest worker program of some size is going to have to come along right quick. Or we're going to have significant, especially if the economy is moving by then, if we've done tax reform that we need to do, if we've done some of the regulatory reform, I can see this economy really moving along and needing a lot more in the way of farm workers and construction workers and landscape people and the whole nine yards.
I couldn't agree more. I think, I mean, while we didn't really talk about it per se, I think the potential for our economy is maybe better than it's ever been in the environment for us as one of those industries that benefits from a strong economy. Maybe as much as anybody in agriculture, we get that extra kind of a ping bonus. People don't, when their lifestyle improves, they don't endeavor to persevere and eat more chicken. They want to, you know, celebrate with a steak. And so I think, you know, from that perspective, we're the winners in that. And again, it comes back to this very component. You brought it up in your initial profile of the question. We've had shortages of cattle, and as an industry, we can calculate and figure that out. And there's a natural means for addressing that. It takes a long time, but we get there, and we can figure that out. If we shut down a plant for whatever reason it is, and certainly because of labor, which to the point that Steve made, is something that might potentially take 3 weeks for us to really remedy. That's a much bigger impact, I think, than what we recognize, and that's one of those things that we need to steer away from. We wouldn't accept that risk in any other segment of our production. We just wouldn't accept it, and yet we kind of acknowledge that it exists, and we're again, packers talk about it a lot, but producers really need to think through this and figure out how they want to actually go through the system. Someday maybe robots will do it all. That ain't tomorrow, and somebody's going to have to train the robot even then. So we'll have to cross that bridge later.
Well, our livestock producers are going to have to take some of the load on to make sure their members of Congress understand what kind of calamities we're talking about if we don't follow those rules real close.
Yeah, I agree. Immigration is the firewall issue on Capitol Hill that separates the two sides. I actually think there's some ways for us to use some of these sub-issues inside of immigration, though, that we can actually bridge that gap a little bit. If you talk to Debbie Stabenow in Michigan, who's one of the agriculture leaders on the Senate side, she's one of the people that's going to drive part of that debate, whether she remains ranking member or not over the next 4 years, she's going to be involved in the conversation. Specialty crops and a lot of the things that her district is codependent upon have exactly the same problem that we just discussed in the beef industry. she becomes one of the people has to, that, and just not resolving it is not an issue. They have, again, her part of agriculture has exactly the same problem, and she's got a beef problem as well. But there's some natural allies out there for us. Maybe this is one place where the rest of the country in California can help fix the problem. I have trouble trusting California members on much else, but they know that if you take the economic value out of the Central Valley and the Inland Empire, you've crippled California for the most part. Maybe this is the way that we bridge it.
Well, you'd think so, but the way they've handled water issues out there during the drought the last 2 years, not given very any indication that they really have very concerns about the serious amount of produce and tree fruit and everything else that comes out of that valley in California.
Yeah, I
don't know. You know, that there's a logic there, Jay. But when you're talking California, what's logic got to do with it?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that about wraps up this four-part series of the Beef Roundtable. Bert and I would like to thank Steve Dittmer and Jay Truitt for being our guests on how the 2016 election might impact the beef industry. Please join us again next week for another Beef Roundtable discussion.